ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The Oscar goes to One Battle After Another.
Academy Awards. One Battle After Another won 6 Oscars tonight for casting, actor in a supporting role, adapted screenplay, film editing, directing, and best picture.
The Hollywood studio Warner Brothers had a great year last year, and it had a great week this week because 2 of its films, Sinners and One Battle After Another, won big at the Oscars, winning almost every major category. Now, the media giant Paramount is set to take over Warner Brothers and its sister company HBO. That is, if the regulators give their approval. It's set to be the biggest Hollywood deal since Disney bought 21st Century Fox back in 2019. Hello, this is The Screen Show. I'm Jason DeRosso, and we're looking at the business of show business this week. Coming up, a panel with 2 industry experts, film scholars Rory Elkington from QUT's School of Creative Arts and Digital Media Research Centre, and Nicholas Godfrey, a senior lecturer in screen at Flinders University. Rory and Nicholas, a very warm welcome to The Screen Show.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jason.
It's really interesting, I think, to talk about Hollywood in this long tail after the Academy Awards, because our minds are focused a little bit more on the films and the other kind of screen content that does come out of North America. And it's an opportune time, I think, to maybe reflect on where we're at given the last 10 or so years of studio consolidation. Rory, maybe I can start with you. How is the health, I suppose, of the North American screen industries at the moment? I mean, Hollywood in particular, if we're looking at the amount of films being made, where are we at?
Well, where we're at is certainly not back to the pre-COVID days. You know, Hollywood broadly, in terms of the number of companies and studios, in terms of the output of its films, in terms of box office, in terms of attendance for theatrical, it's not in a growth phase. It is still struggling to get back to that pre-COVID era. But increasingly, that's sort of fading further in the rearview mirror. So these comparisons with 2019 are kind of growing a bit more difficult to make. The studios are making fewer films, absolutely. And as we saw in previous eras of mergers and consolidation, if we think of 2019 with 20th Century Fox being taken over by Disney, this usually does not equate to more films. This creates to job losses, creates to fewer films. Studios merge. And what we also see is a less diversity in the kinds of films that are being made as well. So competition and a lack of competition doesn't usually open up more, either in volume or in diversity. So we're very much seeing that now.
Are we also seeing less films made in the sorts of categories that once used to populate the best picture category, for example? I mean, we are seeing less adult films being made, however you define that, but let's be loose about it and put it in air quotes. But are we seeing less of those being made and distributed?
So adult dramas, which very much were traditionally this awards backbone, they're only 7% of ticket sales in the US last year, which is about half of the share from 20 years ago. Comedy, I mean, I'd urge listeners to think about the last time they really engaged with a comedy in a cinema. Comedy is down even more. So we're seeing a big shift in not just the number of films, but certainly the kind of films that studios are deciding to invest in, get behind, and release. So if audiences are wondering, you know, why they haven't seen a really good rom-com or a comedy, and there's so much sort of what might be elevated horror that is kind of landing on their screens, that's why we really are seeing a deliberate shift from studios around the kinds of films and the number of films that are being released. The 6 major studios, and that's the 6 that we currently have, the releases are down 35% from the early 2000s. So that's a significant drop. Audiences can't go see films that aren't in cinemas. You know, it's a really clear through line of we can only go see what is available. And although box office is down, there's also a really clear line that is being drawn by industry commentators around the number of films being released. There's simply fewer films, and that's going to have an impact, an attendant impact on the box office as well. So that argument that yes, box office is down, but the number of films that people can buy, purchase, attend is also down is a compelling way, I think about the current state of affairs.
Nicholas, what do you make of the Oscars this year and the predominance of two films coming from the same studio, essentially, Warner Brothers, and what that says about the health of the industry, or perhaps what it says maybe about how effective Warner Brothers have been in managing their slate and building their slate in the last 12 months?
It's quite a surprising result, Jason, simply because if we go back 12 months ago, there were a lot of headlines about Warner Brothers being a studio in big trouble. They'd overcapitalized on very expensive films like Mickey 17, like the Joker sequel, like Furiosa, all of which did quite poorly at the box office, and there were reports that this is a studio in big trouble. So we fast forward, and obviously now we've had the two major contenders, Sinners obviously receiving the most nominations of all time, and then One Battle After Another taking away a lot of the major awards. It appears the fortunes of the studio have changed dramatically, and yet, as we know, it's a studio which is currently up for sale, and it appears likely as we talk right now that it's going to be taken over by Paramount as one of these mergers and acquisitions, which Rory's been talking about.
Yeah, so being taken over by Paramount would lead us to assume that we're going to see less films from Warner Brothers. But what are the Ellisons saying? This is the family that are going to be taking over, hopefully, on behalf of Paramount. Well, they own Paramount. They're going to be taking over Warner Brothers. What have they been saying about what Warner Brothers' output is going to be, Rory?
Well, at this stage, it's all very positive. As you would expect, the promises are that the film output will be maintained. So looking at around 15 titles per studio, if we look at both Paramount and Warner Brothers per year. So these are theatrical global releases. And also committing to that theatrical window. So actually having serious amounts of time that these films will stay in theatres globally.
So, and this in the United States, that means 45 days, more or less. That's the benchmark for that theatrical window.
That is regarded both by theatres and I would suggest by audience as well as a decent window by which you know exclusively that film will be in theatres, yes. But I would suggest we need to treat these claims, especially at this early stage, with a bit of skepticism. You know, the gap between the intentions and what is put out as getting this deal across the line and the reality of the fact that Paramount will be coming in with a massive amount of debt that needs to be dealt with, that they're going inevitably to have to do some merging around staffing and the fact that there's a lot of crossover. So I think, Jason, the world in which there is not going to be a reduction in feature film output from this merger of Paramount and Warner Brothers, I think it's very likely to be the case.
Nicholas, you're nodding your head there. What do you think the potential takeover of Warner Brothers by Paramount means for the amount of films and the diversity of films we're going to be seeing?
I mean, I was just thinking, yes, the studios are producing fewer films, and that's something which has really been in place since the 1950s, but declining year on year since then. But primarily, we're talking before about the decline of the mid-budget picture, the prestige picture. These types of films tend to be produced in the independent sector, and of course, they may establish their value on the festival circuit, and that's where a big studio will swoop in to pick them up for distribution. But in terms of whether it is Warner Brothers or Paramount, the films they're interested in producing tend to be the most expensive, most lavish, deluxe, you know, blockbuster scale of production. And I remember a year ago, what was looming on the horizon for Warner Brothers was this film, One Battle After Another, which was a pinch-on adaptation with a storyline which was quite indescribable with very expensive stars like DiCaprio and a commercially unproven director like Paul Thomas Anderson. And there was speculation that this is going to be a big flop. This is going to be the one that might sink Warner Brothers. Obviously, it didn't play out that way and it did quite well at the box office. But I'm uncertain if we're likely to get other such films under a merged Warner Brothers with Paramount, particularly given what we know of Ellison and the types of films he appears to favour.
Yeah, well, there is a sense that Ellison Sr. especially is very much in with MAGA, And we should point out that this takeover of Warner Brothers would also mean a takeover of other branches of Warner Discovery, which includes CNN. So if it goes ahead, CNN and CBS, two very important news media organizations, will be under the same umbrella group. It also means the takeover of HBO. So therefore, we've got a series, a very successful series like The Pitt, going under the Paramount banner as well. So it will be a very lucrative takeover if it gets approved by the regulators. But just going back a little bit to the Oscars this year, and if you look at the Best Picture nominations, there was a lot made by Conan O'Brien on stage about how international the Oscars were this year, and talking about, you know, films like Sentimental Value being there vying for Best Picture Oscar, talking about The Secret Agent, the Brazilian film, vying for a Best Picture Oscar. It strikes me, though, that they're looking at the silver lining. Once upon a time, Hollywood would have been able to make those films. And it doesn't seem like, I mean, I'd even put Parasite in there. Once upon a time, Hollywood would have made its own Parasite. It wouldn't almost have needed to expand its focus and find a Parasite from Korea, or find, you know, a Sentimental Value from Norway. Am I being too cynical, do you think?
Well, here I think audience appetite for non-English language content has, I believe, increased. And I actually think the streamers have had a positive role to play in this. I think the amount of international content and with great subtitling that has occurred that audiences have access to has actually increased the appetite generally for non-English language content. I think your comment, Jason, that a Sentimental Value in previous years might have been able to be produced domestically is correct, but that is not the situation we are now in. I mean, we have an expansion of international membership for the Oscars. Four of the multi-nominated films this year, nominations were non-English language. And I think this is really reflecting an audience shift to be more amenable, more open to a broader range of content. The Korean wave is a great example of that, than they may have been in previous years. And I suppose the only other point I'd mention is that when we look at the original films that Warner Brothers have put out this year, if we look at Sinners, if we look at Weapons, if we look at One Battle After Another, arguably these are films that have taken pretty big stylistic swings. You know, these were not locked, as Nicholas said, by any stretch. These were big bets by Pam Nabdi and Mike DeLuca, two powerhouse execs who really got behind, I know the word visionary is overused a lot in Hollywood, but quite visionary writer-directors, and really gave them the scope to make these films in a way that they wanted to. And arguably we're seeing the positive results of that being recognised at the Oscars now.
Yeah, Pam Abdi and Mike DeLuca being the two studio heads of Warner Brothers, who famously, the general consensus is that they're quite open to directors having strong visions. But Nicholas, even though Rory's pointed out that these films have swung pretty boldly, made some really interesting stylistic choices, most of where the studio output is centred is on pre-existing IP, intellectual property, and we're in what a lot of scholars call a post-classical period with a lot of films, whereby studios aren't really interested only in making films, or at least they're under conglomerates that are more broadly interested in IP being sold in different commercial streams. So we might have a video game, we might have that same IP being translated into a feature film or a TV series or a board game. And then there's all the merchandising. So studios are now part of conglomerates that aren't in the business of making movies. They're in the business of selling intellectual property, right?
The big piece of the Warner Brothers prize, which is currently being picked over by Paramount, is its ownership of DC publishing, the comics, all of the IP around Batman and that extended universe, which has had varied fortunes in recent years for Warner Brothers as a studio. I don't think they've quite hit upon a winning and sustainable formula in the way that Disney did with Marvel. And yet, commercially, that appears to be running out of steam, which makes me wonder where Paramount will go with the superhero brand if it is successful in taking over Warner Brothers. It seems to me, if we do accept the proposition that the superhero cycle appears to be running out of steam at the box office, that Hollywood's in search of a new formula, and potentially that's going to be video game adaptations. We obviously had the Super Mario Brothers Brothers movie doing very well at the box office. Most recently for Warner Brothers, the Minecraft film, which I think exceeded commercial expectations. So I'm interested, Rory, to hear your thoughts on that and where it might be going.
Mm. Well, Pam Abdi and Mike DeLuca have been on record with this in, I suppose, a deceptively simple approach, which is that they've said when they're looking at a video game adaptation, they approach it in the same way they would a book adaptation. So the property is there, the story is there. They, of course, look to attach the right writers, the right directors. And I think the success of Minecraft does speak to a different approach in those adaptations. And look, I think for people that love movies, we're kind of entering into sort of grim territory to discuss that it's really just about IP and eyeballs and getting it onto it. You know, there's so much that audiences contend with that are prequels or sequels or adaptations or extensions of something that's existing in terms of IP. And the marketing of that, of course, is excellent because it's recognizable to audiences. But again, I come back to, I suppose, the challenge and the bravery of these original films that come out that don't have an existing visibility for audiences that are released. They need to stay around long enough for audiences to find them because they don't necessarily know about them. And I think back to that early release of Sinners, where seeing that film, in particular that key pivotal Duke joint moment, which was just hanging on by a thread in terms of working as a scene. It was such a wild kind of go. It almost became a club to have seen that film in cinemas at the time because people didn't know about it. It didn't have the name brand recognition. And of course, you know, in the light of the Oscars, we look back to what it is now. So I suppose...
Well, it had amazing word of mouth as well, which is gold, obviously. It had a word of mouth that meant that it sustained and even, I think, grew in some territories its box office over the early weekends.
Which is a rare thing. You know, it had to hold, it opened, and then it held. And that word of mouth, as you say, Jason, was integral. It was like being in a club to have seen that film. So I suppose the question is, can these two things coexist? Can we still have this existing IP that is recognisable, that is adapted, and can that create space and perhaps the budget to allow for these original singular stories from these visionary directors that Warner Brothers seem quite keen to continue to invest in? Can those both come through? Of course, I'm optimistic that that's the case.
Well, I'd just step in here and say, with regards to One Battle After Another, I think it's a very flawed film. Marty Supreme, equally a very flawed film, by two very talented directors who've assembled a very talented team of collaborators. But I had this feeling watching both, as successful as they both were when it comes to the flaws in Marty Supreme and One Battle After Another, in my opinion, we're talking about films that don't quite know how to close, don't quite know how to land with the politics or the points they're making. And if you compare them to the non-American films this year, like Sentimental Value or The Secret Agent, those two films both represent a kind of artistic focus. And Secret Agent is a very sprawling film, but they both represent a kind of artistic focus and a sense of internal coherence creatively that says to me they're made by filmmakers who at every point have adequate control over their creative process from A to Z, right? I look at Marty Supreme and I look at One Battle After Another, and I see a kind of incoherence. I see blind spots. I mean, Marty Supreme's got this huge blind spot about it being, I think, quite inadvertently almost racist to the Japanese characters in it, right? So much of it happens in Japan. There's a kind of unbelievability about this character. It's a very unlikable, very narcissistic character. Being able to woo all these women in the film, I mean, it's quite a sort of weird thing, in my opinion, that doesn't quite hold. Anyway, as impressive as it is, it kind of doesn't hold together. And then you've got One Battle After Another, which I think, for all its criticisms of Trump's America and militarization of policing and border panic and racism, it ends up being, I think, inadvertently, it's this film about two white guys, really. The main black character, female black character, has disappeared very early on from the film. And then in the end, it ends in this very sentimental place. I don't know if that resonates with you, Nicholas, but what I think it shows is that in the case of great filmmakers, I think, like Paul Thomas Anderson and Josh Safdie, there's a kind of internalized overthinking about the films maybe needing to be too many things to too many people. And in the process, they're losing an artistic focus in making these films. And the films are quite fragmented and scatty and in some cases, you know, unfortunately have these awful blind spots.
I agree, Jason, in the sense that I think both One Battle After Another and Mighty Supreme are quite sprawling and undisciplined films from filmmakers who potentially always have that kind of tendency. But I suspect this is the kind of ambition that the Academy Awards often likes to acknowledge. Certainly in Paul Thomas Anderson's case, there was a sense that this was a long overdue award for him. And often by the time that recognition comes, it's not necessarily for the most deserving film. We saw a similar thing with Martin Scorsese. But I wonder in terms of the marketing and the positioning of these films, which, like you say, are both sort of tough sells to an audience, I wonder with Mighty Supreme if A24 potentially went a little bit too far with a very calculated tie-in merchandising campaign that you can get your orange New York Knicks hat and you can get, you know, your Hypebeast streetwear jacket that's ridiculously overpriced. I don't know if that brought more people in to see the film necessarily, although it has done okay at the box office. When it comes to One Battle After Another, like you said, Jason, it's quite overt in its visual depiction of the iconography of the current Trump administration and, you know, ICE roundups and quite overt depiction of racial tension in the United States. I think probably Hollywood like to acknowledge how contemporary the film feels, whether or not it ends up saying anything particularly coherent about this moment. But certainly if we compare it with some of the international examples you mentioned, like Secret Agent, like Sentimental Value, and I would add probably Train Dreams as well, the Netflix film, there's a sense of
which coherence. Is a small, and Train Dreams, a wonderful little gem, I'll just interject here, that it a small American film that you get the feeling was allowed to just be made with a bit more of a degree of filmmaking independence. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, and notably was produced independently and subsequently picked up by Netflix after its festival run. But with each of these films, there's a sense of coherence there, which is not necessarily the case with One Battle After Another or Mighty Supreme. There's a strong possibility that both Mighty Supreme and One Battle After Another are sort of cinematic self-portraits of their directors, and maybe both filmmakers are unable to break out of that and see these blind spots that are bound up in the film. And then more broadly, I think in any given year, you probably are more likely to find better pictures from other parts of the world than the United States. And yet the Academy Awards is always a publicity exercise for Hollywood and an exercise in how Hollywood wants to be understood and have itself perceived at a moment in time. And clearly, with One Battle After Another, there's a surface level political engagement with the contemporary moment, which I think is what resonated with the voters.
You're listening to The Screen Show on ABC Radio National with me, Jason DeRosso, and a special panel discussion this week on the business of show business with two experts from QUT's School of Creative Arts and Digital Media Research Centre, Rory Elkington, and from Flinders University, Nicholas Godfrey, a senior lecturer in screen. Okay, but where are we, when we're talking about Hollywood, where are we placing the threat of the small screen for audience attention and money? Because I think along with a kind of demise in so-called prestige filmmaking in Hollywood, there's been a demise in prestige television making as well. And Nicholas, maybe we can look at the example of The Pitt, which is a highly acclaimed series made by Warners, or, you know, it's made by HBO. So it's also about to be, it's one of the IPs that will then come under the umbrella of Paramount, if this Paramount takeover of Warner Discovery goes ahead. What's your opinion of where television's at?
I think The Pitt's a notable example in that it's such a throwback in many respects. It's a 15-episode season rather than, you know, typically we'd see maybe an 8-episode season for the more expensive prestige dramas. It's all set in one location, so there's efficiencies of scale in terms of the production. There's this central device that every episode is 1 hour on the shift and one season spans a single day, like an older show like 24, for instance, which had that quasi-real-time gimmick. And I think in terms of its large ensemble cast, it offers multiple points of identification, which is potentially very useful in terms of bringing in an audience. But there's a lack of pretense there, which appears to be playing very well with an audience. It's an easy show to watch in the way that a lot of prestige dramas tend not to be.
How much do you think it points to the fact that the streamers are just wanting to make cheaper television, Rory?
So I think of Conan O'Brien's opening monologue for the Oscars, where he made a crack about why is Amazon, and they who are nominated for nothing in the Oscars, why is the company that's selling me my toilet paper not nominated for a movie? And Netflix and the streamers are not all like Amazon. We have some pure play streamers that really are focused on screen storytelling. Netflix, of course, being a notable one. But we have to be clear-eyed, I suppose, about the business imperative of these companies, which is to keep our eyeballs on their platform. That is the goal. We can see that with Netflix's foray into mobile gaming. We can see it with their focus on serialized and streaming content. And there's something about the independent feature film with its middle, beginning and end and its kind of containment that maybe doesn't lend itself to the length of time and the investment that streamers may want us to have on their platform. So what does? Well, serialized narratives do. And once we see that shift into serialized narratives, well, then we're looking at things like a cost structure. You know, what is engaging people? We've seen that in Focus Towards Reality and the costs for that. We've seen that probably in a decline in these larger prestige drama pieces with ensemble casts and name actors, which the attendant costs of getting those name actors. So are we seeing a move towards a reduction in that prestige piece and actually just keeping the eyeballs on these platforms? I think we are.
And do you think also equally streamers like Prime and, you know, which is an Amazon company, and Netflix are not bidding as aggressively for prestige films as well? Are you seeing a change in where they're wanting to put their money when it comes to buying films for their platforms?
I think they want the mix. I think they do. I mean, you always hear about this diversity of slate and a balanced slate. And I think for the streamers, there's absolutely still the desire for the prestige and the not just the Oscars, of course, but all the other attendant awards that lead up to it. They still are feature film or Golden Globe related for streaming and TV. So they still want to play in that space. They absolutely still want to invest in the kind of titles that will garner that attention. But I also think that there's a big push towards content that will cut through, that is quick and cheap to make, that's going to be able to attract eyeballs. And we've even seen that extended into, you know, these rumours of content where the script notes that are coming back from Netflix are far more about being able to have much more exposition so that people who are doing their ironing or their washing and have it in the room at the same time are able to follow along with the storyline. I think that has kind of been overdone a bit in terms of a talking point, but I think that push towards having more digestible, shall we say, content that is easier to have and easier for audiences to engage with, we see more of that.
I just add to that, I think the cheapest content of all to acquire for streaming is stuff that's already been produced. And I think that was a major factor in Netflix's desire to initially take on Warner Brothers. Obviously, they were in a bidding war with Paramount. I think this was a factor in Disney's acquisition of Fox, as you mentioned, Rory, because they obtained that whole back catalogue there. Similarly, Amazon bought MGM United Artists, I think primarily because Jeff Bezos wanted to get his hands on James Bond. But nonetheless, this is one studio's acquisition of the whole back catalogue of another. And certainly in the case of Netflix, they achieved a good market position by being the first major streamer. But as all of their competitors introduce rival streaming platforms and claw back the rights to their own titles, increasingly for Netflix to retain its subscriber base and ideally expand its market, I think it probably needs to obtain a studio catalogue of some form.
Rory, do you think Netflix are in trouble now that they weren't successful in taking over Warner Discovery?
No, I don't think Netflix are in trouble at all on any level. I think they are riding high above any other streamer in terms of subscriber numbers, in terms of reach, in terms of budget. I mean, let's not forget that when you walk away from a deal with close to $3 billion in a payment, you're doing pretty well. You know, arguably Netflix have been a real winner from this. So they're able to go back.
Just explain that. Why do you think that is? Just explain that.
Oh, in terms of the deal was advanced to a certain point with Netflix and Warner Brothers, and when Paramount came in, they had to pay a walk-away fee effectively to Netflix, which was to the just shy of $3 billion US. So Netflix is on the receiving end of that for not spending money and buying a company. So arguably that looks pretty good to the shareholders of Netflix, and they have a healthy war chest by which they can look to other acquisitions of libraries, as Nicholas says, which is going to be important for them to continue to grow that subscriber growth. But I have zero fears for Netflix in terms of their ongoing world domination.
What do we make of the smaller studios and distributors now before we, I guess, wind up this discussion about Hollywood and the studios and the streamers? I look to a company like A24 and to a lesser degree Neon. These are smaller distributors that initially start making a name for themselves, distributing kind of edgy art house material. They start to bring some production in-house. A24 was one of the production companies behind Mardi Supreme, for example. It signed on early for Moonlight, which won a Best Picture Oscar back in 2017 or 2018, I think it was, and helped make that film. They're certainly one of the success stories in terms of branding, in terms of having this clear corporate identity about the sort of movies they make and the sort of demographic they look for, which is a very younger, it's a younger skewed demographic, I suppose. Nicholas, how would you define their story of the last 10 to 15 years?
It was quite notable at last year's Academy Awards. We really had an arms race between A24 and Neon with The Brutalist and Anora, respectively. And obviously, Anora was the one that was successful for the Best Picture there. I don't think they were present quite to the same degree in the nominations this year. I mean, Mardi Supreme was maybe a dark horse candidate, but I don't think it was ever really in the discussions in the same way Sinners or One Battle were, and clearly came away with nothing last night. Neon was there with a number of films in Secret Agent and Sentimental Value, but these are titles it had acquired independently rather than producing wholesale, whereas for A24, Mardi Supreme was a big, expensive production investment for them. We did have some reports from A24 a couple of years ago after Everything Everywhere All at Once took away Best Picture that they were going to invest in producing more expensive films and films with a more commercial audience in mind. But I wonder how far they will continue down that road. And given the strength of their market positioning, as you say, whether they can effectively cater to their existing fans and not spread themselves too thin by chasing a broader, more mainstream audience as well with more commercially accessible titles. We don't know, but that's always the maxim in Hollywood, right? Nobody knows anything.
Yeah, Rory, are companies like A24 the future for, you know, quality American-made, you know, predominantly American-made films that will keep audiences and younger audiences especially going to the theatres to watch big screen entertainment?
What A24, Neon, and I would also include Mubi, M-U-B-I, in this list, what they have done is carve out a really clear point of difference. That is, as you say, youth skewed, but they have a sense of cool. They have an aesthetic that is undeniable, and that extends, as Nicholas pointed through, to merchandising. And the kind of marketing and positioning of their films that is quite distinct. And they really are, you know, to include those three, straddling an interesting line between commerciality and critical success and critical celebration. That, as I say, is a point of difference. And one of the most powerful things about A24, outside of the creative decisions that they're making in acquisition and at a script level, is just the brand itself. You know, it has cut through and a recognizability that is really unusual outside of the studios. The challenge, a little bit like Apple and a whole bunch of other kind of cool tech companies, is that they're going to have to maintain that brand identity and that point of difference as they grow and as they seek to become more of a company than they already are. That's going to be a challenge for them moving forward.
Well, on that note, it has been really fascinating diving deep into the screen industries with you both. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your expertise with me on The Screen Show.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, Jason. Thanks, Nicholas.
Thank you.
Netflix CEO Ted Sarandos is here, and this is exciting. It's his first time in a theater. This is what they're talking about. Why are they all together enjoying themselves? They should be home alone, where I can monetize it.
I hope you enjoyed that discussion on the studio chess game currently being played in Hollywood, a bit of a departure from our regular format here at The Screen Show. Guests were Rory Elkington from QUT's School of Creative Arts and Digital Media Research Centre, and Nicholas Godfrey, a senior lecturer in screen at Flinders University. This is ABC Radio National's The Screen Show. I'm Jason DeRosso. In that last discussion, you will have heard about a streamer that I have mentioned before here on The Screen Show, and that is Mubi. They began as a streaming service of niche and art house titles, and lately, as you heard, they've shifted into distribution. And one of their recent purchases from last year is a film that I liked very much when I saw it at the Sydney Film Festival. It premiered in the Uncertain Regard section at Cannes, and it's had accolades since then. In February this year, it won the award for Outstanding Debut Film at the BAFTAs. The film is called My Father's Shadow, and it tells the story of two boys who are living with their mother in the Nigerian countryside when their father comes calling. His sudden appearance is the beginning of a journey that they will never forget. He takes them to the capital of the country, Lagos, where he has friends and business associates to meet. And that excursion is an eye-opener in many ways. It coincides with the 1993 Nigerian presidential elections, which were supposed to end years of military rule, but the military had other ideas. My Father's Shadow is a tender and insightful drama about childhood set against the backdrop of enormous societal change. And it is screening in Melbourne at the end of the month at the Africa Film Fest Australia, and then in early April it screens at ACME. Then, next month, anyone can see it over at Mubi. I caught up with the British-Nigerian filmmaker Akinola Davies Jr., who co-wrote the film with his brother in Sydney last year.
You know what? Go and wear your clothes. You are following me to Lagos today.
But Mama said we shouldn't leave the house. That we should wait for her.
And why don't you stay and wait for her? You can tell her I went with Daddy to Lagos, but he put you in charge.
Hopefully, your mommy comes back before we go. But otherwise, you just have to leave a message for her. Go now. Sharp, sharp. I don't have time.
Akinola Davies Jr., welcome to The Screen Show.
Thank you for having me, Jason.
Tell me about your childhood. First of all, this sounds like I'm about to psychoanalyze you. I'm not, I promise. But it's an interesting one because you're born in the UK, but grew up in Nigeria.
Yes, correct. So I was born in London, and then we went back to Nigeria and spent most of our sort of formative first years growing up there. My father passed away when I was really young, so my mum was a single parent having to sort of cater for four kids, my sister, my two brothers, and me being the last. So my two older siblings were already abroad by the time my father passed, and there was me and my brother, who are 2 years close in age. We predominantly were in Nigeria till our sort of early teens, and then we went over to the UK.
So it remains, I mean, I know the short film you've done before this was also about, set in Nigeria, and you work a lot there in your commercial practice as well, right? You do a lot of fashion work.
Yeah, totally. So basically, when I sort of set stall out to become a director, I was shooting bits and pieces in the UK and then managed to conceive an idea of shooting in Nigeria. I think this was probably way back in 2015. And that was one of the first times me and my brother worked together. He was producing for me back then and I was shooting, and it just kind of embodied a freedom and a sort of wildness that I really enjoy as a filmmaker. It just felt like there's no boundaries. And then off the back of that, my brother created a service company for us to be able to travel around the country and just basically service and produce our own projects.
Do you find that your creative process dovetails into the industry that's already there, Nollywood and so forth, or are you sort of parallel to that?
That's a really good question. I think it's a bit of both. I think we, more recently doing the sort of narrative stuff, so my short film Lizard and now My Father's Shadow, we definitely work with a lot of technicians who are in Nollywood. So actually a lot of the processes that they're really used to, there's a bit of a shorthand because they make films on a really rapid basis. Whereas some of the other projects we used to do before, which was more like fashion and commercial stuff, you would have to bring some specialists in from the UK or wherever. But I think basically what we try and do is like we really try and raise the standard for the local technicians, because we've had the privilege of working in Europe and America, and we're really trying to give them the best means forward to just focus on their crafts.
All right, tell me about how old you were when your father died.
I was 20 months, so pretty much a baby.
So this is a film that you and your brother have written in which you're imagining the father that you didn't really know, but also there's a kind of approach to that, isn't it? I mean, this is a film about a father's legacy, a legacy of values, a legacy, even though it's shot just over the one day in Lagos. Tell me about that. Tell me about building this character who was your father, but you didn't know. So what was that process like?
Sure. So my father, who I'm named after actually, he was evidently quite a larger than life character. Growing up in Nigeria, we would go out to friends' homes and meet their fathers and their parents, and we'd always have a very similar reaction. Once we would tell them who we were, they were like, oh my goodness, we knew your father. And then the stories would become more and more sort of mature the older we got. We would just get told these anecdotes about this man who we certainly kind of didn't hear at home. So we would hear it from all these male figures who used to like be his drinking buddy or his friend or his sort of partying buddy or colleague. Whereas at home, our mother gave us a more intimate perception of who he was. So we were basically collecting all these memories from periods of time. And equally, we were trying to shape our own memory from what we recollected, because again, I would have been just short of 2 years old and my brother would have been about 3-4. So we have a shared memory of him, which is only really one memory. So I think he conceived a short film whereby we were spending the day with him and sort of piecing this person together. And when we decided to develop it, we had to sort of inject our own personalities into these characters. And the younger character is kind of distant, who's more interested in the mother, and then there's the older character who's more interested in the father. So you kind of had this relationship of three of them all learning about each other in the day and sort of like holding his absence accountable.
Do you think were there moments where you're angry at him writing this? Because it's a very tender portrait, and you know, I'm sure your father would be very happy with this film in terms of it's the way that it portrays fatherhood and a father trying to, certainly a guy trying to make ends meet and not always there, but when he is there, trying to impart some kind of wisdom and sense of values to his son. So it's a very tender portrait. However, you sort of mentioned that there are all sorts of stories that would emerge as you got older and people thought you were ready to hear them about your father.
I would say over the course of my life, I've been through numerous stages of grief. I would say, you know, when you don't know someone, it's the first instance is like, how am I supposed to construct an understanding of someone I never really knew? But when you're getting like this reverberation of this person's character consistently, you start to think of what you missed out on, what you lost on in comparison to your friends and their fathers. And I can't necessarily speak for my brother, but I think he used to go around pretending that like our father was like a secret agent to his friends who'd like traveled for long distance. So I think he definitely had a different relationship. Whereas, yeah, I probably was the more confused and somewhat angry one, especially over my teens, trying to really understand, okay, well, I'm literally named after this person, you know, so I'm kind of a constant reminder, at least on that level, that whenever I say my name, people are like, oh wow, you're Akin, but you're also Akin's son as well. So I think, yeah, it's just a lot of emotions that you go through. But I think the beauty of that is that obviously I'm a grown man. I could condense all those versions of grief into this film, into these characters. And I think similarly for my brother, we had like a lifetime basically worth of emotions to try and put into this subject matter. And equally, I think doing it from a child's point of view just meant we got to really ask the questions that maybe we would love to as adults in this film.
Is there a specific kind of African and more specifically Nigerian template to the father figure, do you think, that you were trying to tap into?
100%. I think, I think that is very nuanced, because I think growing up, what we understood as a culture, or still understand as a culture and a society, is that the man has to provide. Maybe in the global north, that's a little bit more antiquated, even though I still think it's still prevalent. But I think certainly in the context of Africa, in the context of Nigeria, in the context of Lagos, there is a necessity to provide for your family. And I think that necessity means that there's a certain distance placed between that provider and the family, because you're consistently working. So there was always a thing of, like, even going to friends' houses, like, everybody super scarcely sees their father, because it's like working literally, like, you know, 9 till 9, and then they come home and they eat and they go to bed. But it just means that the mothers are sort of the continual caretakers and the people you interact with on a consistent basis. So yeah, there's just, you know, and then equally, my brother also realized that, you know, in Nigeria, there's a lot of people that work within service of a household. And basically, they would work in Lagos, which is the metropolis, and they would send money home to their families. So even in that notion, it's like, you're working to provide for a family you never get to spend time with. There's just a sort of bittersweet notion to that, which I think is quite predominantly Nigerian.
So you decide to make this film, given all of that, and that backstory is clear in the movie, that the father hasn't been very present. You decide to make this film about a day that this absent father does get to spend with his two kids, going around Lagos, and some of it's fun. There's a bit of swimming. There's some good eating. There are some jokes. There's some candy handed out. Mm-hmm. But there's a serious mission that the father's on, and that is to, you know, locate some missing pay.
Sure.
And it's also a very tumultuous day for the nation. So tell me about that conflagration of stuff going on in the film, which you really weave really beautifully.
Oh, thank you so much. I can't take all the credit. I have to give my brother, who's the lead writer on the film, and he was also a father within the process of us writing the film. So I think a lot emotionally shifted for him whilst constructing it. But yeah, I guess in the short film he wrote years before, the concentration was on that family unit, on what they would do in Lagos for the day, how they would spend that day, and the sort of tensions that they were trying to extract from each other, the younger brother trying to find out one thing, the older brother trying to learn another thing, and the father just being on this mission and then maybe realizing he's there for a slightly different purpose. So that was the kind of micro, but the sort of macro was the sort of politics at the time, which I think it kind of runs parallel with the story. It's this idea of like promises or this sense of like a promise deferred, like a dream deferred, you know, like Nigeria was in 93, I would have been the same age as the younger character, and my brother would have been the same age as the older character. And we really remember that there was this swell of enthusiasm in 93 to move from a military dictatorship to what was framed as democracy, which I'd never known in my lifetime. And I think the country were really behind this sort of like father figure, mercurial politician, or businessman actually, he wasn't a politician at the time, who everyone believed encompassed this idea of moving Nigeria forward, like really making us claim this position of like the African giant and something like that. And I think what happened on that day kind of broke a bit of sort of moral or emotional trust within the people and the political elite, because here's this thing promised as democracy, here's a thing everyone participates in, but here's a thing that we never get to actually partake in. And I think there is a parallel with the boys. Like, here is this person that they sort of, here's this person that they love and they believe that they're going to spend a lot of time with. And, you know, does that get fulfilled in the end in very many instances? So I think, yeah, it kind of felt really like a really crucial period in Nigerian history that we certainly remember and lived through, but it felt really fitting to tell a story on that day as well.
So the macro story of that disappointment, ultimately that political disappointment for the country, is in a sense you saw it as a there was a metaphor there about fatherhood and the disappointments of children.
Totally. We saw it as it works on so many layers. I think, at least for us, there's a brotherhood aspect, there's a fatherhood aspect, there's a nationhood aspect, and I think all those three things work quite in tandem together, because I think Nigeria, in our national anthem, there's talk of like our fatherland, you know, and actually a lot of that is what I think me as a person and equally the country were kind of deprived of, and Africa probably in general. A lot of political leaders who had a promise of taking care of the people and a real promise of like moving their countries forward, but either their lives were cut short or politics sort of played a backhand and they weren't able to fulfill all these promises of leading their countries into something that was in service of the people.
Well, and so it makes it a very important scene when your father is telling, I think, the older brother, to take care of the younger brother. There's this sense, perhaps that's a subliminal message in the film or a subtext of the film, that really the elites can't be relied on, or the political father figures, quote unquote, can't be relied upon, and it's up to perhaps the people, you know, symbolised by the brothers in this case, to kind of look after each other, to find solutions from the grassroots.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting thread. I hadn't considered it that way, but I do think it definitely plays that way, because I think, you know, that there is, at least the way we grew up within a particularly like matriarchal community. It was always our aunts, it was always our mother, it was always cousins. Our mother did a great job of encasing us within this family structure. And we all, when she had to travel, we stayed with our cousins. When they travel, they stayed, you know. So ultimately, there is this notion of having to take care of each other, because actually what happens in these moments of grief, or what happens in this moment of unrest, is that you become closer to the people you're with, and actually you realize that that is your first point of contact as community.
Filmmaker Akinola Davies Jr., speaking to me at the Sydney Film Festival last year. His delicate and fine debut feature, My Father's Shadow, screening in Melbourne at the end of the month at the Africa Film Fest Australia, and also at ACME at the beginning of April. And also in April, you will finally be able to watch it on the streaming platform Mubi. That's it for another episode of The Screen Show. Thanks as always to producer Sarah Corbett. I'm Jason DeRosso. See you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.